This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
In the alleyways of London, the Ripper hides from sight, patiently awaiting the ladies of the night. Annie Chapman, the Whitechapel whore, is standing in the lamplight, hoping she can score. The streets are all empty, so she starts to walk on home, passing the evil Ripper, who sees that she is alone. Emerging from the shadows, he pulls her to the ground. Her mouth is muffled in his hand. She cannot make a sound. He draws a savage dagger from underneath his coat, and showing her no mercy, he swiftly cuts her throat. He shifts her to the shadows and removes her underwear. He rips her private places and leaves the body. Then, like an apparition, he disappears unseen, the most notorious killer that there has ever been.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Through the Abyss podcast. I am Ben.
And I am Mandy.
And today we will be diving further into the Jack the Ripper case as we move on to victim number two, Annie Chapman.
Oh, poor Annie Chapman. She's the one that was found in, not to jump ahead, but she's the one that was found by that guy's doorstep, right? By a fence.
Found in a backyard on 29 Hanbury Street, near a fence. She was in a backyard. So yeah, she's very, her story kind of similar to, Marianne Nichols, but in the same regard, like her upbringing kind of was a little bit different, but it's just, as you go through the story, you just get more and more a feeling of how these women got the name Unfortunates, right? Because just series of unfortunate events kind of takes them from different lives to basically having the same life. So it gets real depressing real quick.
Yeah. And the sad thing is that, and I hate to say it this way, but it just really makes them easy pickings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, honestly, just like today, that's, you know, how many serial killers do we have now that go after our ladies of the night? Because unfortunately, not a lot of people miss them.
Right. Right, right. Very true. All right. So you ready to dive into Annie Chapman?
Let's do this. Poor Annie.
All right. So Annie was born Eliza Ann Smith in Paddington in 1840. She was one of five children to George Smith and Ruth Chapman. George was a soldier, so his family kind of bounced between London and Windsor. So her brother said that she actually began to drink at a very early age. Her siblings, like I said, she was one of five. They actually had a lot of concern about her drinking, so they staged an intervention, and they had her sign a pledge to never drink again.
Oh, wow.
The pledge, yeah. So they cared about her, right? So she grew up with a family that actually did care, right? Her father had a job. Her siblings cared about what she was doing. So she didn't have this unfortunate beginning, but she did still turn to alcohol. I'm not sure if there just was nothing to do in England at this time period or how so many people are turning to alcohol at young ages, but
well, her, it's probably easier to get than, and probably cheaper than like what, opium, I guess, was the other big thing that people did back then.
Right. And drinking ages probably were like non-existent or very lenient. Right. So,
oh, they probably didn't have drinking ages.
Right. So children were probably drinking pretty regularly. Right. So, her pledge to not drink was short lived. Her family did end up at this point, moving, without her. She stayed, where she was, just because she was a servant for a family, so she had a job. And her father, he ended up attending a horse race with his boss. They didn't give a lot of detail on this story. I kind of have some speculation that I think most people would have, but he lodged with his boss after he went to the horse races, and he committed suicide by cutting his own throat. Clearly speculation, right? But you might think maybe he didn't do so well in the horse races that night, right? He kind of, or he just was a depressed human being, right?
PTSD. I mean, he was a soldier, right?
That's true too. Yeah, I guess there are lots of reasons why this could have happened. But so this was one of the, kind of the first major knocks in her life. Mm-hmm. Despite that, though, people described her as being very sociable, hardworking when she wasn't drinking. Due to her long, dark hair, she often had the nickname of Dark Annie. In 1869, she married John James Chapman. Don't be confused. Her mother's last name was Chapman as well. And yes, this is a relative, which probably also was a little more common back then. I'm not sure exactly how she was he was related to her, but it was related to her on her mother's side.
Hopefully distant cousins.
Yeah, hopefully like 12th cousin or something like that. But they lived in various places around London. And in 1870, John had a job working for a nobleman on Bond Street. The two of them had three children, two daughters and a son. And the children were kind of another source of just devastating events in her life. First, her son was born crippled. She still obviously loved him. And actually, people said that's why she didn't drink as much as they would have figured she should or would have, because she was busy taking care of her son. So that was actually a positive factor in her life. But one of her daughters ended up dying of meningitis, which led both her and her husband to drink excessively.
I understand that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You kind of, that mental image is popping in my head, just the incest. I wonder if that played a part in the meningitis as well as...
And the crippled son, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're related, so there's more chance of having abnormalities at birth, right, if you're closer in genetics.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. So because of the alcohol, she was arrested multiple occasions for public intoxication. The couple did end up separating in 1884, but John still paid her a weekly allowance, which ended up funding her living quarters, which was just like Marianne Nichols, the common lodging houses. These common lodging houses, like the more we get into these stories, just strike me as just once you hit them, like there's like no turning back. It's like life is destroyed because you're just a creature of the night, right? Living from prostitution and other means. But
although it's kind of like with Polly or with Marianne, though, I mean, just based off of what people have said, you know, the living conditions were horrid, obviously, but she seemed to maintain an air of, I don't know, a happiness, I guess. Because, I mean, didn't people always say she was always smiling and always kind of in a jovial mood or something like that?
Yeah, they did. And Annie Chapman, people said she was very sociable and a hard worker as well. She actually was a little better off with her husband's money. She was able to afford a $8 bed a night, which was a double bed, right? So
$8?
Yeah, because he was
saying, did it really say $8?
Well, it says 8D. What would that be?
Eight.
Probably wasn't $8, right?
No, because dollars is US.
Yeah. Eight somethings is what she was paying. And we know from the Marianne Nichols, right? She was paying four.
I'm gonna have to look that up because that's gonna bug the crap out of me.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's paying twice as much, but getting twice the bedding. Her husband sending her 10 Ds a week. So she's able to afford that. By 1886, she lived with a wire sieve maker, but he kicked her out when her husband died from liver failure from alcohol and her money ran out. So another just hard knock, right? She's her father commits suicide. Her one child is crippled. Her other child dies of meningitis. Then her husband, who, even though they're not together, he's now funding her well-being, he dies. And the money stops abruptly. It actually said that she had to inquire as to what occurred, as to why the money stopped. She didn't even realize that he had died initially. So, yeah, once she figured that out, her life drastically changed. By 1888, she now stayed frequently at Crossingham's lodging house at 35 Dorset Street. So that's kind of like her residence.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I actually watched, it was a video on YouTube, but it's a really good company who did this. Some guy was actually walking down Whitechapel now, and there's still a couple buildings that are there that were still around or were around in the 1880s. One was like one of the pubs. The pub was like 10, I can't remember what the heck the name was, but I mean, it looked exactly like it did, well, for the most part,
yeah,
back then. And then there's like a church right there, but then he did a shot down Dorset Street. Obviously, of course, it's changed, but it's weird to see the then and, you know, go back and look at pictures of the now. It was actually very interesting. And I will put up a link to that as soon as I find it again.
Awesome. So sometimes her bill was paid by Edward, the pensioner Stanley. We remember that name, Edward Stanley, who would later be a suspect for a short while. He was kind of her boyfriend, I guess you could say, and sometimes he would pay for her lodging. But for the most part, to make money, she actually crocheted items and was able to sell some of those. She sold flowers, and then she, of course, supplemented her income with prostitution. That seems to be the growing theme of that area at that time, and definitely of the Ripper victims. She fought with a resident very often named Eliza Cooper, who had struck her and given her a black eye just 8 days before her death. Eliza, to my knowledge, was never listed as a suspect, but her life, just kind of putting that in there to illustrate that her life was not easy, right? In these boarding houses, it was pretty much alcohol fighting, prostitution. It's kind of the way you went about your day to day. On the day before her death, Amelia Parker saw her having just been released from an infirmary, looking very pale. Later in the autopsy, it would be revealed that she had a long-term illness and that Annie Chapman would have been dead within 2 to 3 months had she not been murdered. Even extra depressing, like she had no chance, right?
Man, so, she just like, I don't think they called her Dark Annie because of her hair. Damn.
Right. I mean, it was because of her hair, but it really kind of like was a reflection of the life that she would lead. Just a very traumatically tragic life. So, yeah, it's very, very sad.
Did they say what kind of illness that it was?
They said it was a lung illness, and she was taking pills for this long-term lung illness. I would assume it was, is tuberculosis a lung illness?
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty popular then, or maybe lung cancer. I don't know. It didn't really go into, these people had such alcohol issues that they don't really discuss what they smoke and things like that, right? Like cigarettes weren't really notable back then, but these people were probably also chain smoking and doing other things.
Oh man, if she had tuberculosis, that would be horrible, especially in the environment that she was living in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would have just made it so much worse, so much quicker.
On September 8th, Annie, this is where the story gets very similar to Marianne Nichols. Mm-hmm. She was in need of the $8 for her double bedding. This was verified by the lodging watchman and the house deputy. They had said that she had gone out to try to make that money. At 12:10 a.m., she had a beer at the lodging house with a fellow inmate named Frederick Stevens. She dropped some pills on the ground in front of him, scooped them up, and put them in a torn envelope and headed out.
So yes. I was looking back because this is, you know, stuff like this bugs me. And it's not dollars. I think it's farthings.
Farthings.
Or pences one. Because like it doesn't really give me, because it's not pounds. That would be way too much.
Yeah.
There's no way they could afford 8 pounds for a bed. No.
This is oddly disputed because you think this would be like either was or either wasn't.
Yeah.
But it is argued that 2 pence.
Uh-huh.
Were laying on the ground by her body. It was not in any police report, but two different police inspectors later said that 2 pence were laying by her body. So it's possible.
So it probably is pences then. if anybody out there listening, because I know we have some England people who listen to us, if you could set us straight on this just for my own peace of mind, I would love it. So please, please, please comment or email us or something. But I am very curious to know what would be the equivalent of the dollars in 1880s London.
Yeah, we don't adhere to the saying that ignorance is bliss. We like actual hardcore knowledge. So yeah, please.
Yeah, it's going to keep me up at night, people. So please, yeah.
All right. So once she scooped up the pills into the envelope, which later we'll find out were her lung pills that we kind of discussed, she heads out. At 1:35 a.m., she returns with a baked potato. She ate it and left again to make her money. All right, so she comes back 1:35 a.m. People see her there eating a baked potato. Elizabeth Long testified that she saw Chapman talking with a man just after 5:30 a.m. Just beyond the backyard of 29 Hansbury Street, Spitfields, she said the man was over 40 years old, slightly taller than Chapman, had dark hair, was a shabby sort of genteel, and seemed foreign to her. He had a brown, low-crowned hat, a dark coat, possibly. And to say possibly, and I was like, how do you not know if this man has a dark coat? Or does? Anyways, he possibly has a dark coat. She heard the man ask, will you? And she heard Annie say yes. She says she is certain it was Chapman, and at the end of the time, due to the cock crowing right before she had entered that street, which strongly suggests that her description is that of the killer based on the timeline.
Stop for a second. I can't believe you actually get that line in. Like, she heard the cock crowing. See the rooster crowed. I'm sorry, I'm being immature right now.
Yes, go ahead. Very much. No. Anyways, yes. So due to the timeline, we'll see that's hearing them talking at 5:30, very, very likely that this was the killer. Just before 5 a.m. on September 8th, the son of a resident at 29 Hansbury Street, John Richardson, went to the backyard to check the locks on the wine cellar and cut a piece of leather off of his shoe. The cellar was locked, so he sat down and he cut the leather off his shoe. He said that he heard and he saw nothing. That was 5 a.m. At 5:15 a.m., Albert Kadosh went into the backyard of 27 Hansbury, to use the lavatory and heard a woman say no, no, before hearing something hit the divider between the backyards of 27 and 29 Hansbury. However, he did not inspect further. Wow, what a citizen we have there. He hears a woman scream no, no, hears a thump on the fence beside him, and he's like, yeah, it's really not my business.
Well, I mean, you know, going back to what we talked about in the last episode with this particular area, I mean, it was crime ridden all over the place. So
yeah,
well, I mean, people may have been completely apathetic towards it.
Absolutely.
Is one thing. Absolutely. But I mean, you could also maybe on kind of like, I feel sorry for the person who might be getting killed, but I don't want to get my throat slit, so I'm just gonna pee and go back inside.
I mean, that's all 100% legit, and also it's not a good thing by any means, but he probably just thought he was hearing a domestic violence dispute, which back then was just not your business, and you just went on about your business, right? So
yeah. Oh god, even now people half the time don't give a shit.
Yeah,
we've become a very apathetic people.
So after Kadosh heard the sound, a little later an elderly man of 29 Hansbury, John Davis, found Annie Chapman's mutilated body. They said this was just before 6 a.m. Her body was on the ground near a doorway to a yard with her head 6 inches from the property steps. Davis alerted James Green, James Kent, and Henry Holland, who quickly went and found Divisional Inspector Joseph Linus Chandler. They told him another woman had been murdered. He followed them before getting police surgeon George Baxter Phillips. Several police arrived minutes later. Dr. Phillips arrived at 6:30 a.m. He quickly linked the death to the murder of Nichols, as both had 2 throat cuts from the left to the right that went bone deep. In this case, the cuts extended almost all the way around her throat. The size of the knives would also have been similar, and abdominal cuts were consistent. There were 6 areas of blood splattering on the wall of the house, 2 pills, the torn envelope, a muslin, and a comb were found, as well as a leather apron near her soaking in a half a basin of dishwater.
Interesting. Leather apron. That throws shade on some
people. It's very interesting. And as strange as it is, as we hear like further, it ends up kind of seeming like it's probably nothing, strangely. But from an initial thing, it's like, man, this dude is a really, really, I mean, how organized of a serial killer do you have to be? If you take yourself a basin of dishwater, I'm gonna start cleaning my garments right here. I mean, it'd be amazing, right?
This also brings to mind something else, but we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Don't forget, sounds important. Two police later say that two farthings are in the yard as well, but it does not make the police report. Phillips states her left arm is across her breast. Her legs are propped up onto her feet, right? So her legs are kind of bent so that her feet are flat on the ground. There's a handkerchief around her throat, but it was not applied after death. So I'm wondering if it wasn't just part of her fashion. She just has a scarf around her neck. Or maybe since it wasn't prior to her death, maybe he was trying to stop
the blood spurting.
Ooh, that could be too.
Because she was alive at this point, right? When he cut her throat this time?
Yes.
Or no?
He cuts her throat. Well, it doesn't really say. It just says the handkerchief was applied prior to death. So that's she wouldn't have had her throat cut at the time of application of it. But I'm just wondering, like, if it was a lady's... I took it meaning it was like a lady's scarf and she had applied it herself. But I guess it also could have been something he was strangling her with to kill her prior to cutting.
I don't know.
Her tongue was swollen and protruding between her perfect teeth. It does say her teeth were perfect. I think just to kind of counter act that Marianne Nichols was missing some teeth, right? So her teeth were perfect. Strangely, there was no sign of a struggle. In this case, as different from the other case, this had the two cuts, this had the spilled innards. Her uterus and bladder had been removed and they were gone. So they are gone. He believed that this must be a medical person again, as the organs were removed with precise and very limited cuts. So even though the body, yes.
This is where it's so strange because I mean, the organs are removed. What's the time frame? Because like, when did he say hear the no-no? Because obviously she was still alive.
Yeah, the no-no was 5:15 a.m. Her body was found at 6 a.m.
Well, I mean, 45 minutes, I guess, yeah. I guess that's not so close in time. I was thinking it was a lot less time that he had to actually do that.
Yeah, and if you think about it, though, from the initial, like, he heard no-no and then he heard a thud, which you assume is her body hitting the fence, right?
Right.
So if it's her body hitting the fence, that would be the first two cuts that killed her.
Yeah, I mean,
then
she would
since
have
no
to
one intervened. He's got 45 minutes.
So
roughly 40 minutes to work with.
That, but I mean, that kind of says that the cuts were done pre-mortem instead of like strangling. Because you hear no-no and then you hear a body going up against a fence.
You're talking about
throat
cuts?
Yeah. If she was being strangled, surely he would have heard some kind of noise coming from that after she said no. Because it would take, it takes, from what I understand, a few minutes for someone to actually die from manual strangulation.
Yeah. Other than the scarf around her neck, though, there was no mention of strangulation in this one.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll just assume that he cut her throat while she was alive then.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was six areas of blood splattering this time, six areas of blood splattering, whereas opposed to Marianne Nichols, there was no blood, right? So this one, he's not really being careful with the cleanliness, other than if you think the bucket of water is his, and then he's like, I'm just going to get that afterwards this time.
No, but if there was blood splatter, she would have had to have been slit while she was alive, because once your heart stops beating, there's no, spurting of anything, really.
Right. Right. So, that's why I kind of just wonder if the handkerchief wasn't just like something she was wearing.
Yeah.
the bladder and uterus, they were gone. And like I said, he believed that the cuts were so precise and that even though her body was mutilated, the amount of cuts that were used to remove the organs were very, very minimal. So that made him think that this person had a very in-depth knowledge of anatomy. However, as we had discussed before, you also would remove organs if you were a butcher or something to that extent, right? So there's other ways you could know about removing organs, just from prepping meat, I would think.
Or some weird twisted individual that just decides to hack into people and see the innards just for fun.
Yeah, and like we've discussed multiple times, you've brought it up multiple times, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, that Marianne Nichols probably, even if you don't count the other two that were near, probably not the first victims, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this person's developing skills as well, right? So
right.
Although this is the first body where they've noticed organs being taken, so due to the fact that there were minimal cuts, if this was the first organ harvesting, then maybe you could see this person could be of some sort of medical expertise.
Oh yeah, because I don't think a butcher would be able to precisely, well, I mean, he might, I don't know, I'm don't know any butchers to ask, so
yeah.
But I would lean more towards medical.
And even though an animal is an animal, the anatomy of say a deer, not the same as a woman, right? So to just quickly yank out the uterus, probably I'm probably not giving that the amount of credit it deserves.
I've had anatomy and I might fumble around for a minute trying to figure out what the hell the uterus is, because you know,
yeah.
I'm sure I've never actually worked on a cadaver before, so I don't know how gross it is. And, you know, yeah, with her just being dead, you know, there's a bunch of blood still sitting everywhere, so yeah.
Right, and they did say the body was completely mutilated, right? So
mm-hmm.
I don't know if he removed his, he probably, depending on what he's doing with him, probably removed the organs first and then mutilated, right? But it's also possible he's just cutting everywhere and then he's like, oh wait, let me get this uterus out, right? I don't know, right?
I guess it would depend on what he was doing with them, because if he was using them to sell, I would think he would probably more delicately take them out first and then, you know, start hacking away.
Absolutely. All right. So the doctor also determined that she was sober at the time of her death. So we knew she had had the one beer with the inmate earlier, but apparently hadn't done much after that. So she was sober. Coroner Baxter actually drops a bomb later, stating that an American doctor had been searching for a uterus and that this could be the reason for her murder. He says this, it like inflames everybody. It later is determined that that doctor is determined to be Francis Tumblety, who is a major Jack the Ripper suspect, but the theory was rejected quickly as he was said to be a reputable doctor and he had been said to have left the country 8 months prior to that, so I'm not sure. The theorists that Francis Tumblety is the killer, how they put him back into the country, but that's something we'll look at later when we get into the suspects. But for now, they're saying that Tumblety wasn't there, so there's no way that it could be him, and the theory is rejected. Mm. However, we've talked multiple times also about, you know, H.H. Holmes being theorized as possible person. Tumblety is an Irish-born American, and H.H. Holmes also an American.
Mm-hmm.
So if he was in that area at the time too, Holmes also a doctor, also would have possibility of having reason to want to do this. I'm not saying Holmes is the killer, but just putting that name out there too, because if you're looking strictly the fact that they're looking at a doctor, they're looking at someone who's foreign, and then multiple descriptions actually link the possibility of it being Holmes as well.
Not to mention timelines fall into place with this one too.
Right, the timelines kind of fall into place because the Holmes murders in Chicago start about a month after Jack the Ripper's killings abruptly end. But again, we'll go into all that when we jump into suspects. The theory, like I said, was rejected. The apron at the scene, which looks like a big red flag, ends up being John Richardson's. You should remember that name. John Richardson was the young man that overheard the no-no when he was using the facilities in the yard and heard the thud on the fence. His mother had put it out to soak, and she testified to that. It was his from work, and she's just cleaning his apron.
Well, there's your dishwater.
Yes. By the way, I think I forgot to mention earlier that John Richardson lives in 27 Hansberry, which is, so he's the next door neighbor there. So
right.
They have reason why their stuff would be there. So he was investigated, but he was eliminated as a suspect. The journalists of the time ended up being extremely angry and pushed more and more for the pressure for the rumor of Leather Apron to be explored, because they thought the police were missing the clear and obvious suspect. And they began printing very crude Jewish stereotypes as Leather Apron. John Pizer was a Jewish man, and they were trying to stir up hatred towards Jews and calling him the killer.
I want to interject something here real quick.
Yes.
The last episode that we did, you were talking about, I think you pointed out that someone was a Jew, one of my friends had commented, she thought it was kind of a crass statement, but it wasn't meant to be that. It was just pointing out the fact that during this time, there was a lot of hatred towards Jewish people. Yes. And it also factors in to a later suspect, the Jewish aspect of it, which I'm, you know, not going to get into right now because it's not impervious to this particular person. But just wanted to interject the fact that Ben and I are not anti-Semitics.
No.
Don't think that for a second. It just, the Jewish part does play a role in this case, because back in that time, like I said, there were a lot of anti-Semitic people and a lot of, you know, very bad things were done to these people. Just, you know.
Yes, 100% true. And I'm sorry that I didn't express that in the last episode.
I didn't catch it either, so it's okay.
yeah because the reason that I keep mentioning that he was Jewish is because the hatred of the Jewish people was so bad at the time that these journalists jumped on the fact that he was Jewish and were making derogatory Jewish statements and saying, this guy's killing our people, you guys need to do something about it, which led to the arrest of him on September 10th. Mm-hmm. Though he was let go as his alibis for both of the murders were airtight. So they arrested him and he was let go a couple days later because his alibis stood up. And so they were not able to pin it on Leather Apron. The envelope piece that was left at the crime scene.
Go ahead.
Did you have something?
Well, it makes me angry. Here, we're gonna arrest you because you're Jewish and because that's what, it's like people being tried via social media now. Do we not ever learn from our mistakes?
No, never.
God, it's just like, I mean, literally, it's the same damn thing that happens today, just, you know, with computers and the internet.
Yeah.
It just infuriates me.
No, yeah, it's crazy, and it's what they did, and the papers were able to basically try and convict this man themselves.
Exactly.
But his alibis were too tight, so he gets out.
Well, thank God.
The envelope piece that we've mentioned a couple times, she had grabbed the envelope piece when she left the lodging house to put her pills in. It was linked to her ex-boyfriend, Edward Stanley. That was Edward the pensioner Stanley, who used to pay her boarding sometimes. Mm-hmm. So he was also investigated, but he also had an alibi for both murders as well. Right. So he just happens to leave this little piece of an envelope back at the lodging house where he used to stay with his girlfriend. Now, unfortunately, that interrupted his life for a spell too.
That's awful. Cause I mean, he was actually seemed like a good guy, help, you know, paying her money and stuff like that. That's just people.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Unfortunately, he didn't pay her lodging every night or else.
Well, unless she drank it away, like, you know, Polly did.
Yeah, that's possible as well, right? And unfortunately, you know, we know she was also very sick, so she didn't have long to go anyways, but that's a side note. Two other suspects were arrested as well. A Swiss butcher named Two other suspects were arrested as well, a Swiss butcher named Jacob Eisenschmidt, because he resembled a man a woman said she saw covered in blood screaming derogatory phrases against women that night. So I'm not sure who the real person was that was screaming the derogatory phrases against women that night, or if it was Jacob Eisenschmidt, but that sounds like a pretty good piece of evidence, possibly.
I don't know, because, I mean, this guy's been pretty slick so far, right? So right. If you were covered in blood, unless you were having some kind of like a manic attack, I don't think you'd be screaming derogatory response or things to women.
Yeah, probably.
And
not.
If you were in that state
like
of mind,
like a butcher or something.
Yeah, but I mean, if you were in that state of mind, I don't think you'd be able to remove organs in a precise manner.
Right, and we know that Jacob Eisenschmidt was a Swiss butcher, right? So he has reason to be covered in blood. That's true. Not necessarily from murder, right? So, the other person that was arrested was Charles Ludwig, who was a German hairdresser who tried to stab a man that night. And he had tried to slash a woman's throat on another occasion. So he's a very horribly violent person, right? But again, that's what the time was then, right?
Yeah.
Like those things were normal, right? So even though he tried to slit a woman's throat, you'd be like, well, that's pretty telling. But both were let go because two other murders occur while they were both detained, right? So they arrested these guys. Obviously, Charles Ludwig was not arrested initially as a Ripper suspect. He was arrested for stabbing the man, right. But then they're like, "Ooh, this guy might also be the Ripper, so let's hang on to him." But unfortunately, two other people were killed while these men were in jail, so they were let go. She was buried in a communal grave that was paid for by her family in Manor Park Cemetery, and very equally depressing to that of Marianne Nichols. It took till 2008 for her to be mentioned on a plaque, but they've lost the exact location within the communal cemetery. So it just says her remains are buried within this area. And that's as close as you can come now to Annie Chapman's actual final resting place.
Just terrible.
Yeah.
I think about how many people have been forgotten.
Yeah.
Graves lost. I mean, I probably have people buried on our land in Tennessee because, you know, way back when you couldn't afford to be buried in a cemetery, so you get buried on your own land. My God, wow. I have bodies on my retirement community, not community, retirement land.
You want to hear something even more depressing than the fact that it took till 1990 something for Marianne Nichols to be acknowledged and 2008 for Annie Chapman to be acknowledged? To me, this is even more depressing. Had they not been killed by Jack the Ripper, they never would have been acknowledged. So they're not acknowledged for themselves. They're acknowledged because of the sensationalism of the crimes committed against them.
True. Yeah, it sounds like they both had pretty decent friends. I mean, do you think that if they had died, poor Annie was on her deathbed anyway. I think somebody probably would have buried her, and, you know, there may still have been a stone, you know, tombstone. But Polly, I mean, unless her hooker friends could come up with money, I don't know. I mean, did they have, what are those places called? Name one on my head. Heart Island is one in New York, where they bury, like, mass graves.
Well, yeah, that's what
Pottersfield.
Yeah.
I wonder if they had those back then.
Well, yeah, that's what this is. So her family paid for a communal grave. It's a
mass grave. Okay.
Yeah, that's why. So it was probably just really common back then that you just mass grave and then no individual markers. But my only point was, like, had she not been killed by Jack the Ripper, like, never would there be any sort of individual marker ever. But then you got to look at the rest of the people in that communal grave. Again, never going to have an individual marker ever. Kind of just like forgotten and done.
Well, I mean, would you want to be remembered for a horrific crime that happened to you by a serial killer who has never ever been caught, or just to wink out in oblivion?
Wow, those are both really thrilling options. I guess I'd rather have a tombstone that just said, "Here lies Benjamin Dallas Jones. He did okay."
There you go. Mine's going to say, "Here lies Mandy Loftus. She was buried alive."
Oh, Lord.
Actually, I'm not going to be buried. I'm going to be cremated, and my ashes are going to be taken to Romania. So if I don't have any family members alive, that's your job, Ben.
Copy that. If I go to Romania, it's going to be in my Dracula coffin that I sleep in every night to freak out the locals.
I wouldn't do that because they'll kill you. They believe in that shit. Yeah, that would not be a good idea. I don't know. They do sell a lot of Dracula shit over there, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's everywhere.
I mean, you got to make money off of the Dracula. All right, guys. So that's going to be it for Annie Chapman and the second Jack the Ripper victim. So thank you guys for joining us. I am Ben.
And I'm Mandy. And as always, please like, subscribe, leave a comment, do whatever you need to do. Rate us 5 stars, please. You can get a hold of us through our email at throughtheabysspodcast@gmail.com. And we are also on Instagram and Twitter at abysspodcast1. Have a great day. Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss Podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff!